Oh, yeah. Frank, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Thank you, Brian. It is an honor to be here. I want to thank you for asking me to speak. This clubhouse is, I've never been here before, and it is a truly impressive space. I want to thank all the ones that welcomed us. I mean, I feel like I've been away for years and years, and I've come home or something. It's great. It is truly an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak. My sponsor used to tell me that speaking is probably the least significant commitment I could have in AA. And I think what he meant by that was, I've never been here before, and they asked me to show up and run my mouth about me for half an hour, and they get the heck out of Dodge. You know, what kind of commitment is that? You know, that'll get you drunk. You know, I mean, it's the commitments that have the literature and make the coffee and clean up afterwards and set up the meeting. These are the commitments that keep you coming back week after week, especially when you don't want to be there. Those are the commitments that have been significant to me, that have reduced my isolation and saved my life. So it's truly an honor to be asked to come and speak. Also, I want to say that if you're new and you think my hand's shaking, you're seeing things. No, I kid the newcomer. No, I had about, my sobriety date is December 20th, 1982. And I was about 15 years sober. So I guess 12 years ago, I got diagnosed with this. And you're not crazy if you knew. My hand is shaking. I have extraneous movement. I got diagnosed with Parkinson's like 12 years ago. And it's the least of what's wrong with me. You can trust that. Just ask her, you know, she'll tell you. But my friend always says, don't sit next to me when I'm eating soup. It's a funny story how I found out about it. It's a perfect disease for an alcoholic. I had never been to a neurologist before. You know, you have to go to a neurologist to have this diagnosed. And I didn't know. You know, I never met a neurologist. This guy didn't know me. So I walked in his office, I sat down, and he goes, what's up? And I said, well, my hand moves when I'm not moving it. So you tell me what's up, you know? And the first thing he asked, without even knowing me, he says, well, how does it respond to alcohol? And I thought, wow, you know, I felt like it was a strange question. Apparently that's how they determine whether it's Parkinson's or not, if alcohol works on it. And hell, I mean, I thought, you know, I guess what it is, my hand needs a drink, you know. Now, I paid him $500 for that piece of information. Hell, I could have told him that, you know. And the rest of me needs a drink too, you know. Oh my God. Yeah. So, you know, I feel like that Peter Sellers movie where he had the hand that used to attack him, you know. So you can watch it shake or listen to what I have to say. It's up to you. It has a life of its own. And when I say it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to come and share an AA, you know, speaking is an opportunity for me to go back. And, you know, like we were reading in the beginning of the meeting, I love that passage we read about us not being a glum lot, you know. We're not. But I do have a hopeless state of mind and body called alcoholism. And when I speak, I get to go back and remember who I was. you know, the things I did, what I thought, how I thought. I lived in a very hostile world. When I was drinking, it was a dog-eat-dog world. I was out to get mine before you took it away from me. And I was convinced you were out to take mine away from me. I say, if I'd had anything, I had nothing to give, and if I had anything, I wouldn't have been interested in giving it. You know, that was the world I lived in. And that kind of terror, that kind of perspective, renders you useless. I was truly a useless human being. You know, anything that I see myself to be, anything I have that's of any value, but most especially, any use I am on the planet, anything I have to offer, any service I have to give, is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And it's these 12 steps, the fellowship that introduced me to the book, and the book that introduced me to these steps. And my sponsor was quick to point out to me that the first 11 words of the 12th step are having had a spiritual experience as the result. The result. I'm rarely close enough to it to point to it. He said it was the only thing we were working on. That was all that I was doing here, was to get this psychic change that could change who I am and everything about the world around me. And so that's a debt I'll never pay back. And speaking is an opportunity for me to go back and visibly remember, you know, the reality of my life before AA. Also, I hate speaker meetings. If you're like me, you know, I don't blame you if you, you know, unless I'm the speaker. Then I have a great time. Then I have a good time. But other than that, I hate speaker meetings. So I'll try and make this as painless as possible. The reason I say that is I got this story. You know, when I say any use I have on the planet, anything I have to give, I came to AA, I came to my first meeting, because I was a blackout drinker. I would drink on like a Wednesday, and the next thing I'd know it was Sunday. You know, I'd drink on a Sunday, next thing I know it was Wednesday. I'd come out of these blackouts, and, you know, I came to AA to learn how to drink again. I didn't know what it was about. I had had an uncle when I was a kid that used to go to AA, you know, and he'd get sober for three or six months. And families start coming back together. Then he'd start drinking again 6 months later. Everything fall apart and he'd go back to AA to learn how to drink again. I thought that's what it was about. I had no idea what this was. And I came here because I needed to get the click back. For me to think of life without, you know, going through life conscious was just not in my paradigm. You know, I mean, there was no thought of that. You know, I had to live by that click. But sometimes I would black out before I'd remember getting the click, you know, that sense of ease and comfort. So, you know, I thought this was about learning how to get the click back. I did not know what truly the program had to offer. I'm 26 years sober, and my son is 22 years old. And that means even if he never drinks, I got more time than him. And I remind him of it constantly. But, you know, he's my best friend. Now, it was not in the cards for who I was when I got here to be a parent. That was not when I came to AA. You know, an adequate parent. You know, pretty good one. That's been something that this fellowship's done for me, and it's unbelievable. But when he was a kid, I was 2 when I married his mom. I was about 4 years sober when he was born. So he was 3 to 4. I was about 7 years sober. His mom went back out, and she took off. And I was by myself raising my son. And I had a friend of mine who lived across town. He was in the program. And he was a single father, had a daughter. And our kids used to get up on Saturday mornings, and I tell this story because I learned it from him. And it's my entire story. If you got to cut out early, I can tell you my whole story in 2 minutes. He used to love to watch these Saturday morning cartoons. My buddy of mine's daughter and him. And we'd get on the phone together while our kids were watching cartoons on Saturday mornings. And we'd try to figure out how to make pancakes, you know. And we'd be on the phone, and their favorite cartoon was this Roadrunner cartoon. You know, it goes beep, beep. And we would get, my buddy and I would be on the phone. We'd be watching this with our kids. And it got to be very serious. We discovered some things. We decided that one of us must have written this cartoon. And that if you went back far enough, there's this Wile E. Coyote in that cartoon. You know, and he's chasing this Roadrunner. And you go back far enough, you're going to find that one day, this coyote, way back when, caught a Roadrunner. And he ate it. And it fixed him. Man. It was like a spiritual experience. You know, he was irritable, restless, and discontented until he could again experience that sense of ease and comfort, like it says in the book. He ate his Roadrunner, and it was Bugs Bunny Day, man. Everything was good. All was fixed. An instant fix. So he is now going to spend the rest of his life buying Acme rockets, strapping himself on board, lighting the fuse, running his head in the side of mountains, falling 500 feet to his death on the off chance that he gets one more bite, a Roadrunner. Now, I don't know about you, but that's my story. And there's not much more to say about it. That is the bottom line on my drinking. And, you know, it was funny. When I got here, I wanted nothing to do with the spiritual part of this program. Best thing I could say about God when I got here was it was dog spelled backwards. And I wanted nothing to do with the G word. So for about a year and a half, 2 years, the only part of this book I could read was the very first part. It was an introductory part called Doctor's Opinion. And there was a line in there that said, any message that was going to hold the attention of this class of drinker had to have depth and weight. And I love that. You know, you want to hold my attention, you better have depth and weight, right? Well, I found it in this Roadrunner cartoon. You know? And we continue to watch this thing, and it got silly, the analogies. I mean, we thought, this is really heavy, you know? We'd be watching this thing, and we realized he always knew where the Roadrunner was. You know, if he had 10 things going on that day, he always knew where that bird was. He never lost track of it. And the end of every episode, they'd put like 4 episodes together, and the last one would always end the same way. And we noticed this, and it got, like I say, we thought, this is not for kids, you know. At the end of every half-hour series, he would be like, you know, the coyote would still be chasing this Roadrunner. He'd be beat to hell, man. He'd have like a black eye and a bandage on his head and a broken arm and a sling and a broken leg with a crutch. And he'd be like on one roller skate, you know, going after this bird. And the bird would move and he'd go off the edge of the cliff and he'd defy gravity for about 2 seconds. You know, he'd look down, see where he's going to fall, look back at the camera, all beat up, smile, this huge smile, and whip out a sign, and it said, super genius. Then he'd fall to his death. Now, my 5-year-old can't even read the word genius. You know, who is this message for? You know, and that's heavy, man. That's a heavy message. And we got in all kinds of discussions about that. My sponsor used to tell me, he'd say, when what it does to you outweighs what it does for you, you'll give it up. So for that coyote to look that beat up, well, if you knew what it did for him to find that solution, you know, what it did for him was so significant, you'd know he was a super genius for chasing it. And it didn't matter what it did to him. And that truly is my story. And it's something I'm always asked to tell that story, but I attribute it to my parenting and, you know, some alcoholic that used to work for Warner Brothers, I guess. I don't know. Enough about that. In a general way, what it used to be like, what I'm what it's like now, like I say, try and make this as painless as possible. I'm from Beaumont, Texas originally. Beaumont is 90 miles east of Houston. It's about where I'm from in Beaumont. It's about 4 miles from Louisiana state line. Now, the significance of that is when I was 14 in 1967. So that makes me 56, right? 56. And you don't have to think about it. So I told you the answer. But I was 14. When I, in 1967 in Texas, you could get a legal driver's license at the age of 14 in 1967. And I got a driver's license, and my father gave me an old 58 Chevy Delray. It was like an old work car. Another thing that my sponsor used to say, I always say, is that, you know, I never drank in high school, and I never drank in college. I never went to high school, and I never went to college. But I was 14, and I had this car. This Chevy Delray was like a tank of a car, huge car. And because I had this car, I got to hang with guys that were older than me. They were like 16 to 18. There were six of them. There was one of me. We called ourselves the Magnificent Seven, right? A little delusion of grandeur or whatever. But we would pile in this car on the weekends, and we'd drive 4 miles over the state line in Louisiana. Now, you couldn't drink in Texas till you're 21, but you could drive at 14. Louisiana, you couldn't drink. You could drink at 18, but you couldn't drive till you're 18. So if you're old enough to drive, you're old enough to drink. They never even checked your ID. So we'd drive 4 miles over the border. We'd go up to this little liquor store, first stop off the highway. It was called Vinton, Louisiana was the name of the town. Liquor store had a neon sign that said, Jack's Packet Liquor. And I mean, I could paint a picture of it for you to this day because of what it did for me, right? It was a spiritual experience. You know, I thought it might as well have been Vegas, this liquor store. And every liquor store I've ever been to in Louisiana, and I've been to a few, there's a drive-up window. You don't even have to park. It's like a drive-through McDonald's or something. You can, it's true. And you drive up, we drive up to this window in the back of this liquor store, and there'd be like this 300-pound guy in there with no hair on his head and a cigar hanging out of his mouth, and he'd say, "What can we do for you?" And we'd order this Boone's Farm apple wine and Boone's Farm strawberry wine. We'd get long neck pearl beer. I remember pearl beer. My favorite was for $1.59, and I could paint a picture of the label to this day. You could get a gallon bottle, whole gallon, huge amount of wine, and it was called Bally High. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It had the sexiest little hula girl on the label, man. It was amazing. And I was convinced you drink that whole bottle, that's how you say I'm very high. I'm very high, you know. You want to be very high? Baseball been very, very good to me, you know. And that was I remember that and what it did for me. It was like everything they'd ever, there's two things in Texas. There's football and Jesus, in that order. And I wanted nothing to do with either one. And everything they had ever told me about this wine was not true. I drank it and it made me feel a part of. I drank it and it fixed every problem I had like that. That instant sense of ease and comfort. I drank it and I felt like, I no longer felt less than. I didn't feel like the run of the crowd or the young guy. You know, I felt like a part of. And it was like, it was magic, man. It was like Bugs Bunny Day. You know, I understand that coyote, you know, whatever. Anyway, we'd have enough money left over to buy one admission to Showtown USA drive-in theater. This is back when they had drive-in theaters. And we'd drive back over the state line. We'd put six guys in the trunk of this car. Here's this one 14-year-old kid by himself buying one ticket with the rear end of the car dragging on the ground because of all the guys in the trunk. And that was my summer of love. And I'll never forget that. You know, I can, like I say, I have Polaroids in my mind of that summer, because it was like, that's when I think I figured out how you're going to get by in life and on the planet. This is how you're going to survive. You're going to have this click, and this is how to be an adult. As long as you got that Bally High wine, you're in fine shape, you know. But I didn't have much of a taste for Texas or the family I came from. They felt like strangers to me. By the time I was 18, I ran away to New York City, and looking for bigger and better highs, I went to Manhattan. I took a job driving cab at the South Bronx Garage. It's called Bell Garage in the South Bronx. And I drove cab, worked my way through school. Didn't talk to anybody from my family for about 3 years. My father died. Had to go home and bury him. Saw my mom. I had a sister that was 6 years older than me. And she was valedictorian of the high school. She was on a Fulbright scholarship to the University of Cologne in Germany. I mean, she had walked a straight and narrow. She had done everything right. Here I was, this, you know, drug-dealing cab driver in New York City. And she had a two-year-old son. He was the only connection with family I had. He was the only person in family who would talk to me, you know. And she got a type C hepatitis in Germany, and they didn't know what it was back then. She came in and out of a coma. For 9 months, she had an aneurysm in her frontal lobe. When I was 25, she was 31. We had to take her off life support. I went home, and I held her son while my mother buried her daughter. And I swore off God. You know, I thought, if anybody was supposed to be dead in this deal, it was me and not her. And that made no sense to me at all. And so, I went after, you know, looking for this high, like a vengeance after that. And like I say, I got to the point where I was a blackout drinker. Every time I'd drink, I'd lose 3 and 4 days of my life. And there's a great trick if you're new and you're a blackout drinker. Or also want to welcome the newcomers. Anybody in here that didn't qualify as a newcomer, welcome to you. That's me. When I got here, I couldn't raise my hand for 90 days. And so I relate to you. And I want to welcome you. But you know, I had a great trick, I remember. I'd come out of blackouts, I wouldn't know what had happened. You know, I'd be in a blackout. And, sounds like the end of the cartoon. And if you find the top 2 inches of a newspaper, free and for free, it'll tell you everything you need to know. It'll tell you where you are and what day it is. And that's vital for a drunk, you know. We laugh at that. But, I mean, that was a great trick. I thought that was the smartest thing I'd ever come up with. Anyway, in 1980, I came out of a blackout. I was on Madison Avenue. There was no doubt where I was. It was a Sunday, and this is back when they first started running color pictures in the front of the newspaper. And there was a full-color picture of the comedian Richard Pryor, 1980, on the front page of the Sunday New York Times, and he was running down Ventura Boulevard on fire. Now, if you're Wile E. Coyote, that looks like a great idea, you know. So I read about what he was doing, and I thought, I got to check this out, you know. So I got a job in L.A., making a lot of money in a little bit of time. I came out here in 1980. It was Thanksgiving of 82. It was a week before Thanksgiving, because it was the first of many holiday parties where they used to give it away. And a buddy of mine was coming over. I was staying with a girlfriend, and she was out of town. And we didn't have any money, but we were going to this party, and it was free at the party anyway. And I remember it was a Thursday, exactly a week before Thanksgiving. He came by at 3 p.m. The party was at 10 that night, but we had to get ready to go. You know, you had to get ready to go to a party. I couldn't go. This guy's nodding his head. Couldn't go out conscious, you know. You had to get ready to go. You know, you couldn't go be seen in the world without being thoroughly numb. So he came over, and all she had to drink was this bottle of gin. I hated gin. It was Tanqueray gin, but it was all she had. And I pulled down a couple of water glasses, and I'm filling them full of gin. And that's the last thing I remember, was pouring this gin. I don't remember taking the first drink, which is a drag, you know. And that was a Thursday. Next thing I know, it's Monday morning. I'm lying face down on the corner of Hollywood and Vine, southeast corner. There's a novelty shop there. And people are walking over me, looking at me like I used to look at the bums on a subway. And I thought, how'd I get here? That was the day. I didn't realize it. And I want to tell you, if you knew, anything I have to say about it from here on is hindsight. I had no idea. You want to know what's going on with me today? Ask me next week. Because I can't tell you right now. You know, I don't have that kind of objectivity. But I can look back on 26 years of when I got sober, and I can tell you exactly what was going on. Everything I have to say about it now is hindsight. Hindsight's 20/20. And I had no idea that morning what was happening. But I look back and I realize on that day, what it had done to me outweighed what it did for me. And I didn't even know it. I came to that morning and people, like I say, were walking over me. I had, my hand has a scar on it to this day where I'd fallen down. It was stuck to the sidewalk. I'd passed out on the sidewalk. Had holes in my jeans. It was not a fashion statement in 1982 to wear holes in your jeans. You know, I'd gotten there from falling down. My knees were busted open. And I had 37 cents in my pocket. And this is back when they had payphones. You know, there was a payphone hanging there. And I had this piece of paper. I was rummaging my pockets, and I found a piece of paper, and it was this old denim jacket. I probably hadn't had it off for a couple of years. And it had a piece of yellow legal pad, torn off the corner. It said Michael with a phone number. Now, I remembered this guy. I recognized his phone, his handwriting, and I remembered seeing him about 2 months before. And we used to bartend together. And I'd seen him at a party downtown, and he had been drinking this Perrier. And I walked up to him. I said, let me buy you a drink. You don't have to drink a Perrier. He said, no, I hadn't had a drink in a year and a half. And my honest response, I said, that's terrible, man. Why would you do that to yourself, you know? You know, let me buy you a drink, you know? He said, no, I've been going to AA. Well, that was the end of that conversation that night. But somewhere in my blackout that night, he must have slipped me his phone number, because I don't remember to this day getting it. But it was in my pocket that morning, and I had 37 cents on me. I remember rummaging all my pockets. I was looking for money. I had a quarter, a dime, and 2 pennies. There was a payphone hanging there, and I didn't think, thank God. I didn't get in my head, thank God, because I was thoroughly at the bottom and didn't even know it. But I had this number, and I remembered Michael, and I gave it a shot. And I picked up that payphone. I called him. He right away recognized who I was. He said, where are you? What's happening? I told him, I said, Michael, I really need a drink right now, but I don't want to get drunk today. I don't want to forget today. And yet I was shaking worse than I'm shaking now. And he said, well, where are you? And, you know, I could hear myself say that. And I realized that you want to drink, but you don't want to get drunk. You must have a problem. You know, it's always so astounding to us that we got this problem. But he asked me where I was. I told him. What must have been about 20 minutes, felt like 2 minutes to me. He comes pulling up his car, he throws open the door, he says, get in. He takes me to my first meeting. It was a noon meeting in West Hollywood Park in L.A. I walked up there, I thought, this guy must have been the president of AA. If you want to get a lot of attention in an AA meeting, show up looking like a newcomer. Let me tell you, and this guy, everybody seemed to know him. Now let me tell you, I always describe it as I was like a dog on a freeway. I noticed this meeting here, the dog on the roof. I love that. I was like a dog on a freeway. You know, I was like a road hazard. You know, what the hell is a dog doing on a freeway? Or on a roof? You know, he has no business being there. Eddie Miracle used to say, he felt like a chicken on a, not a chicken, a chicken too, a turtle on a fence post. He said, I don't know how I got here, but I must have had some help. Anyway, I was terrified. A dog on a freeway is terrified. How would you approach an animal like that? You know, you would approach, you'd have to have nothing but truth and an open heart. And these people were looking at me, And I remember things they said. You know, it was like yesterday. They looked at me, they said, I could see how they looked at my friend Michael. I thought he must have been the president of the group. I'm telling you, the way they treated him, they said, we're glad you're here. I heard him say that. I thought, they don't even know me, these people. And they look clean, and they look like people that wouldn't be talking to me. They said, your friend Michael sits there, why don't you sit here? And they, this one guy with a Brooklyn accent came up, asked me what I wanted in my coffee. I figured I'd put him to the test. I told him, I said, I want light, no sugar. That's how they order it in Brooklyn. He didn't even ask a question. He went to go get the coffee. Told my friend Michael, I said, you know, I spent my last quarter calling you. That guy asked me what I wanted in my coffee. Can you spot me a cup of coffee? He said, it's for free. I was impressed, man. I thought, there is no free coffee, lunch, or anything else. I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. What the hell is this? But that was my experience. It's like it says in the book, it was a message of depth and weight, and I didn't even know it was happening. I look back in hindsight, and I realize that these people seeming sincere and treating me that way was compelling. It kept me there. It wasn't what they said, wasn't what they told me to do. It was how they were and how they loved me, literally. And I didn't even know it at the time, and half of them probably wouldn't have admitted it. But they were. That was what happened. I got greeted there the same way I got greeted here tonight. And I don't remember much about that meeting, but at the end of it, there was a guy that came running. He was in the back of the room. He comes running across the room. He says, where's that newcomer? He says, his name was Bob Burke. He had a three-piece Brooks Brothers suit on and a carnation in his lapel. I thought he was a narc. You know, I figured, what the hell does a guy like this want to talk to me for? He's running across the room and says, Michael, I want to meet that newcomer of yours. Comes running across the room with a briefcase and this suit on, right? I thought, oh, okay, here it goes. He said, I'm Bob. I said, nice to meet you. He said, when's your next meeting? I said, there are others? I didn't know. I didn't know anything about this. He says, yeah, there's one tonight at 7:30 on Santa Monica and Camden. I'm going to be there. Your friend Michael's going to be there. Why don't you join us? Now, it wasn't like I had to check my calendar or nothing, you know. And I thought, okay, sure. And he says, by the way, and he's walking away, and it's like he forgot something. He snaps his finger, and I remember this. He turned to me, and he says, by the way, he says, it's about 2 in the afternoon now. He says, that meeting's not till 7:30 tonight. He said, you're not going to drink between now and then, are you? Now, I must have taken too long answering that question because he went over and made a phone call. Now, I know what Bob Burke did. He had 7 years sobriety at the time, and he had a very important job. He truly did. He worked for the mayor. He called in to work, and I didn't even know it at the time. It takes you years to find this stuff out because something more important had come up. And this was it. You know, I didn't know what a priority was till I got to AA. I had a million of them. I had 250 priorities a day. Now I got one, you know. Anyway, so what he did was is he put about 6 guys together. They took me out to coffee. They sat me on the inside of the booth. They sat on the outside. They put me on the inside. They gave me cigarettes and coffee for the next 4 hours until that meeting that night, and they walked me there. Next morning, I remember waking up my friend Michael. I was slept on his couch. It was about 11 in the morning. He's waking me up. He says, you know, we're driving to this. He says, we got to go to another one of those noon meetings. It was a Tuesday, and I remember this too. Scared the dickens out of me. He says, you know, you called me yesterday at noon. He says, it's 10 o'clock now, or about 10 o'clock in the morning yesterday. He says, it's almost noon now. We're going to this next meeting. He says, I know you didn't drink between those two meetings yesterday. You've been passed out on my couch since then. He says, that means you got a day. You got 24 hours. That scared me and impressed me all at the same time. We're just driving to the meeting. But he explained to me, he says, you never leave a meeting. You don't know when your next one is. And you live your life between these meetings. And if you put that first, and it may sound ridiculous, you will watch all kinds of miraculous things happen around that. Because while that's happening, I'm introduced to this book. I'm introduced to the steps through the book. And all kinds of miraculous things happen. In spite of me. We were driving that meeting. I remember getting to that meeting, that third meeting. Some of the same people were there that were there the day before. I had about that much more self-esteem. About that much more worth. I look back and I realize that simple act was of service to those people on some level. And it made a difference. It was a message of depth and weight, and it kept me coming back. And to this day, I don't understand it. But it works. You know, it really works. Got my attention off of me. I'll tell you this quick story and I'm done. Take about 5 minutes, but this is my third step. This is how the third step worked me. Like I say, I couldn't read this book for about a year and a half, 2 years. That doesn't mean I wasn't working the steps. That doesn't mean the steps weren't working me. I had 90 days and I had never taken a chip. I wasn't much of one when I first got here to participate. I kind of melted in the back of the room. And it took these buddies of mine to get me out to participate a little bit. And I was told at 90 days that I should take a chip. I was told that 90 days was a long time, and that there were guys in the room with a week that didn't know how to put together 90 days. You know, I mean, 26 years, I mean, I couldn't relate to that. You know, that was like, you might as well never drank. But 90 days, maybe I could do 90 days. You know, 90 days is a long time. And so they said, you got to take a chip. So there was this one meeting that gave chips at 90 days. And it was on Wednesdays at noon in West Hollywood back then. And there was a guy that ran it, this little bitty, tough guy from Brooklyn. Old guy, real old. He was 36 years sober. Got sober like with Jesus or something, you know what I mean? His name was Irv Neamy. And I knew guys that knew guys that knew Irv. You know, I'd never talked to Irv, but everybody knew who he was. And this was like his meeting. And there were like 200 people every Wednesday at this meeting. And you had to get there early to get a chip because you had to save a seat to sit down. And Irv sat on the front left of this meeting every Wednesday like clockwork. Well, I got there early to take this chip, and I took a seat, and I'm walking down the aisle, and who's coming towards me but Irv. And like I say, I knew guys that knew guys that knew. I never talked to Irv. Now he stops, and he looks at me square in the eye like he really wants an answer, and he says, "Hey, how you doing?" And he's looking me straight in the eye, and I thought, you know, I didn't think much of anything, but I looked back, and I realized it felt like, you know, that might as well have been like God asking me how I was doing. God asks you how you're doing, you got to tell him the truth, you know? So I thought, well, I'm going to tell this guy the truth. I looked at him, I said, "I'm not doing too good." He said, "Excuse me?" I said, "Yeah, I've been coming to these stupid, I'm pathetic. You know, my rear end's falling off. I've been coming to these stupid meetings for 90 days, sleeping on a friend's couch. I'm in thousands of dollars worth of debt to the wrong kind of people. I used to bartend and deal drugs. I can't do that anymore. I'm still coming to these stupid meetings. I can't find my car. I got a car, but it took me 6 months to find my car. I didn't know where I parked it. And if I found it, I couldn't drive it because my girlfriend's got the keys and she won't pick up the phone. And I'm still coming to these stupid meetings. Nothing's getting any better. My rear end's falling off. I'm pathetic. How are you?" Well, he, like, not even looking at me. He listens to this. This rant and I'm going on. He's looking in the back of the room. It's like he's not even looking at me. He's looking straight through me. He says, "You know that guy in the back of the room?" And I said, "No." He says, "Well, his name's Jeff." And I turned, and he had a stack of ashtrays about 2 feet high. This is back when people used to smoke in meetings. And there were these aluminum ashtrays, and he's dropping them all over the place. And he says, "You know, this meeting's going to start in about 5 minutes. Why don't you go help him put out them ashtrays?" Now, let's review this for a second. You know, this guy comes up to me, asks me how I'm doing. It was tough for me to talk to anybody back then, let alone tell him the truth. I bared my soul to this guy, and he's telling me to go put out ashtrays. And by this time, people are standing around listening. I'm embarrassed. You embarrass me with 90 days, I'll kill you, you know. I mean, I didn't know how to handle that, you know. And so, but I was trapped. I was trapped. I looked back in hindsight, and I realized I was trapped. I wanted to reach out and touch Irv, you know, let me tell you. I was not happy, but I couldn't do that. And what I had to do was take an opposite action. The only way out with these people watching and him standing there was to turn around and go ask this guy. So I went up to him and I said, I'm Frank. He says, I'm Jeff. I said, nice to meet you. I'm supposed to help you with these stupid ashtrays. Where are they? He says, they're back in the kitchen. You can get another stack back there. Well, I walk back in the kitchen. There's a guy back there with an army jacket and a Dunkin' purple butterfly trick yo-yo. Now, when I was 12 years old, I won a mini bike doing a yo-yo trick called walk the dog further than any other kid in my age group, and I hadn't seen a yo-yo in 20 years. And the guy that had this one in the kitchen, he could barely make it go up and down. That'll break your heart if you know how to do a yo-yo. So I walked over to him. I said, where'd you get a Dunkin' butterfly? I hadn't seen one of those in 20 years. He said, and I said, a purple one, those are hard to come by. I said, you can't even work that thing. Let me show you this. And it's like riding a bike. I hadn't forgotten a thing. I took him out in the courtyard. I'm doing around the world and rock the cradle and walk the dog, loop the loop. He's looking at me going, that's amazing. He says, my name's Bill. I said, I'm Frank. He said, how you doing? I said, well, I'm glad you asked me. You know, I'm pathetic. You know? I said, you know Irv? He said, everybody knows Irv. I said, I told him I was doing it, he didn't care. He said, well, what? I told him my whole sob story. Make a long story short, he says, what did you used to do? So I told him a little bit about myself. He gives me his business card. I called that guy that afternoon. I went to work for him the next day. I met my future business partner, which has led me to a career that has fed my faith and raised my son for 26 years. Now, it took me getting a year cake to go to that same meeting, sitting next to that guy with the yo-yo. He nudged me, and he reminded me. He says, you realize we would have never met if you hadn't gone to put out them ashtrays. Now, what the hell does Irv know? Remember Irv? You know? And what was he telling me to do? And all he knew was how to make a suggestion, how to deal with a crazy newcomer in his face. But he knew how to make a suggestion to take on the actions of someone who's fixed. Regardless of what my problems are today, regardless of what I think's going on, if I were fixed, if life were complete, if all was well, what action would I take? What would I be doing right now? And let me act like that. There's a message of depth and weight. Came straight from these steps, which came straight from this book, which came straight from your heart. And I thank you so much for my life. I had a great time. I've loved being here. You guys have a wonderful weekend. Happy Valentine's.